Oh, we are looking forward for a very interesting discussion on some papers. You know, first in the morning.
Ladies and gentlemen,
on institution building.
This is the last day of our meeting.
Socialist.
And as you have, as you can see from the program, we
would like
have
to
a,
give the chance
we are looking forward for a very interesting discussion
about 10
on some papers.
Each, and then,
you know, first in the morning,
and
on institution building and maintenance in Asian socialist societies.
No more than 10 minutes.
And
each, so
we have two commentators. I would like to give the chance
we
first
have,
to make
Professor
their comments
Joe
of about 10 to 15 minutes each. And then
on the papers with Anne.
I hope then Bob
and
Chin Wei Chung and Doug
like
Pike
you, Joe, and we
can
like
respond
you
somewhat.
Your effort to
no more than 10 minutes each so that we can have ample time for discussions.
May
we
I
have Professor Joe Witt here, who will be
the floor
commenting on the papers with Anne.
And give you comments.
And
then I will follow it up with Anne.
I would like to welcome you, Professor Joe Witt, and we would like to thank you for your effort to give all these comments. And maybe may I just give you, you know, the floor
very nice
to start and give you comments. And then I will follow it up with Anne and the paper writers. Please, Professor Javed, the floor is yours.
It's also nice to be asked to comment on a paper by someone, in this instance, Bob Scalantino, who 20
well,
years
it's very,
ago.
Well, it's very nice to be here.
PhD program.
And that's because I live here. It's a very nice place to live and not have to move from. It's also nice to be asked
Bob
to comment on a paper by
20 minutes. I just heard 15,
someone,
I like 20.
In this instance, Bob Scalapino, who 20 years ago examined me and decided I should stay in the PhD program.
There are three papers.
I've
like
waited 20 years for this. Bob suggested that I speak 20 minutes. I just heard 15. I like 20.
But
because I speak quite rapidly, it may indeed be only 15 minutes. There are three papers. I'd like to begin with Professor Scalapino's substantial and explicitly comparative effort to analyze Asian Leninist regimes. What he attempts to do is compare the developmental histories of North Korea, Vietnam, and China with that of the Soviet Union, and does so in very specific terms by identifying as critical in the Soviet case the rejection of class struggle as the defining ideological tenet and political stance in favor of an emphasis on national inclusiveness. And I think he's right, that that is precisely the key issue faced in the developmental history of Leninist regimes, the place and role accorded to class struggle both as an ideological tenet and as an implication for the way in which a party should organize itself internally and in relationship to its population. If I can put it in my own terms, the Soviet regime between 1956 and 1959 moved from a position that identified society as hostile and consequently as a source of political and ideological contamination to a society that is benign but not politically equal.
What one finds in the Soviet
that I think summarizes very exactly the reinterpretation that occurred in the Soviet Union and provided the basis for a quite remarkable change in political organization and attitudes towards its population. Let me put it another way and then proceed to the points in Professor Scalapino's paper. What one finds in the Soviet Union today is a tension between two permanently irreconcilable orientations. The charismatic orientation of a party that no longer has any heroic tasks to perform, but still claims political exclusivity. That is the key feature and Achilles heel of the Soviet and all Leninist regimes in this post-class struggle phase of their existence.
However,
a refusal to admit the existence of political membership outside of party membership and of political space outside of the party arenas. To put it simply, Leninist regimes are incapable of admitting the existence of an institutionalized public arena.
form of
and it is precisely this that distinguishes them from liberal regimes. However, in the post-class struggle period, what they have decided on for various reasons is the need to partially but genuinely recognize the existence of impersonal bases for decision-making. That is to say, for procedures in the form of limited arenas for market economies and for evidence as the basis of making decision-making rather than insight and storming. These two, what one might call legal rational, elements tend to conflict with the continued charismatic orientations of these parties, something that I'll develop a little bit later. I want to develop one thing right now. If one looks at post-class struggle Leninist regimes, that is to say, Deng's China and Khrushchevian and post-Khrushchevian Soviet Union, in the terms that I've mentioned, the continued demand for political monopoly of membership and organization, in contrast to the need to recognize the benign nature of the population as well as the limited but real role for procedures and evidence, then one, I think, can answer a question that Bob raises. And the question is the following. Can one conceive of the effective institutionalization of political rights for the citizenry at large under Marxism-Leninism, or some further evolution of the People's Republic of China in the future? At present, the answer is not clear. I would suggest the answer is very clear. There is no possibility of evolution towards effective citizenship rights in any Leninist regime. Now, I hate like hell sounding more conservative than Bob.
Leninists see themselves as priests.
But I would like to suggest to you that it is not a matter at all of one's political stance, but of one's theoretical understanding of the character of Leninist organization. Leninist organization and its members have to be understood in terms of status, not in terms of role. Leninists see themselves as priests, not as ministers, Catholics, not as Protestants. There are no such thing as partial priests. You're either a priest or you're not a priest. That's not true with ministers. Ministers can be liaisons at the university here with fraternities. One of them is an Episcopalian minister. You don't meet priests who are part-time baseball managers. The point I'm trying to make is the Communist Party is priestly in its self-conception and its organization. One does not gradually evolve status into role. I'm not denying the possibility that the political hegemony of the Communist Party might be terminated. But if it's to be terminated, it will not be terminated by reform. It will be terminated by a reform that leads to a traumatic crisis within the party comparable to that in Czechoslovakia in 68, in which the regime is faced not with an easy but a hard choice. And hard choices mean mutually exclusive choices. They will have to go back toward a neo-Stalinist form, or they will have to go towards a liberal democratic form. The choices are really quite stark for Leninist regimes.
In the basic sense.
Now to get to the main theme in Bob's paper, and that is the comparability of what's happening in China, North Korea, and Vietnam to what's happened in the Soviet Union. I think it is quite clear that Deng's China has indeed approximated the Soviet Union. In fact, it has become a Khrushchevian regime in the basic sense. If one looks at the major characteristics of this regime since 1978, one finds the intellectuals now considered part of the people, a differentiated rather than Manichaean view of international politics, a limited but real recognition of the integrity of science, an emphasis on educated cadres, a greater appreciation of legality, and most importantly of all, a condemnation of two things that are critical to a Stalinist consolidation or class struggle regime, and that is notion of enemy of the people as being the central contradiction, and cult of the personality as being the basic format for leadership in the party. Both of these were explicitly rejected at the 6th Plenum of the 11th Central Committee of the Communist Party in 1981, which is the equivalent, the exact equivalent of the 20th Party Congress in the Soviet Union, and it took the expression of the resolution of certain questions in the history of our party. However, I think there is in Professor Scalapino's paper much too great a tendency to assimilate the developmental patterns of Vietnam and North Korea to the established patterns now of the Soviet Union and of China. And that, I think, at the conceptual level, takes one expression. There's just too little appreciation in Bob's formulations of political contingency and political conflict within a Leninist leadership as mediators of developmental stages. That is to say, there is an emphasis in Bob's paper of two things: the basic similarities among these regimes and the fact that the trend is towards the negation of class struggle as a primary orientation and cult of the personality. And while he may be right about the long run, what fascinates me is the intractable nature of short runs in political life. And I want to give you some instances of this, which shouldn't be boring. If one looks at the conflict between personnel policies and organizations in Leninist regimes that have favored class struggle and those that have not, the encounters between them have been important and consequential, short and long. Between 1934 and 1936, there was a fight in the Soviet Union as to whether to go beyond class struggle or to maintain class struggle. Class struggle won, and Stalin killed everybody who disagreed with him. Between 1946 and 1949 in the Soviet Union, the same struggle occurred, and all of the objective laws of history said that the class struggle people should have lost. The Soviets had rallied around the party, they had beaten the Nazis, and on. Stalin took those who disagreed, killed some, and purge the rest. Between 56 and 58, the same issue occurred, and this time, finally, the good guys won. And that was an instance of Khrushchev defeating Molotov, Kaganovich, and the others. If one looks at the history of China, one finds the same instance of conflict, not only between 76 and 78, but also between the entire, within the entire decade, 56 to 66. In the Chinese Communist's own words, in this resolution at Hu Yaobang's, forgive me for the mispronunciation of every name I mentioned today, but also in Hu Yaobang, except my own, Hu Yaobang's speech, and occasionally I miss there too. The point simply is that this conflict between personnel, alternative policies, and alternative organizational formats occupied an entire decade in China's history. That, in the interpretation of the current leaders of the Chinese People's Republic, and they're right. One can see between 56 and 66 at different times one group, Zhou Enlai, Chen Yun, becoming more or less influential. On the other hand, you get Lin Biao, you get Mao Zedong, finally Jiang Jing, and all those numbers around her, four, whatever it was. The point simply is that there is a continual struggle and an indecisive struggle that leads finally to the victory, not of the progressive trend in history, but the negative trend in history. And that is the reassertion of class struggle, and the great proletarian cultural revolution is, in its essence, identical to Stalin's great purges. There is no difference. The rationale is exactly the same. The consequential differences are in the means of carrying it out, the Red Guard versus the secret police. But it has the exact same ideological rationale, as pointed out in the resolution statement by the Chinese themselves, Mao in 1962, absolutize the class struggle, which is exactly what Khrushchev accused Stalin of in 1956, making the argument that the enemy grows stronger as socialism gets more victorious. All right. But if one really wants to look at the much more interesting political intractability of developmental trends in communist countries, and not simply the inevitable outcomes, one has to look at North Korea, which remains one of my favorite avocations, revealing a centrally perverse element in my makeup. The point simply is, if one looks at Professor Chung's paper, he points to something that a number of observers of North Korea have emphasized, and that is, beginning in 1972, the central role of the presidency and the Central People's Committee, and the corresponding and apparent diminution of the Politburo's role in North Korea. In fact, one can go a hell of a lot further. One can point out that since the mid-70s, the role of the government has increased, apparently at the expense of the party, both symbolically and substantively, in North Korea. Not only with the beginning of Kim becoming president, the fact that the introduction of the second seven-year plan was done without a party congress being held, at the 30th anniversary of the republic, there was hardly any mention of the party. And when the second seven-year plan was introduced to the Central Committee, it was done so by a relatively unknown government functionary whose name I wouldn't even attempt to pronounce.
All right.
If one looks at the emphasis on the president in North Korea, and if one looks at several other things that make North Korea in some ways the most fascinating of Lenin's regimes, namely the very symbol of the Korean Workers' Party, and someone will be sure to correct me if I'm wrong, namely a brush across a hammer and sickle which speaks to the importance of the intellectuals. A point which is very different from the history of the Soviet Union, where from 1928 on with the Shakti trial against intellectuals, and of course the proletarian cultural revolutions, almost negation of the intellectuals, in North Korea the appreciation of intellectuals relatively but significantly has always been greater than in either the Soviet Union for most of its history and of China. Since the mid-1950s, there's been little of emphasis on the notion of class struggle, but rather again on inclusiveness, with Kim being the center of the regime. The point being that there are a number of features that speaks to this post-class struggle emphasis for a very long time, even prior in some ways to that of the Soviet Union. At the same time, the maintenance of a class struggle orientation. You have an amalgam of both, in my mind, decisively in favor of the class struggle orientation, but it is not at all possible, therefore, to say that the other, while secondary, is inconsequential. And the emphasis on the class struggle not only takes the form of ideological statements, but the cult of personality of Kim Il-sung, which in and of itself, by the way, tells us nothing. Cults of the personality exist in many different Leninist regimes and have extremely different meanings, which has not been specified in any of the literature, which has to do with most of the major points in this field. The point I'm making now is that if one looks at the cult that was being developed around Khrushchev and Brezhnev, one looks at the cult of personality around Nikolai Ceausescu, and looks around Kim Il-sung, you have three very different types of cult of personality that should be recognized as such. All right. The point I want to make is a serious one. And that is, while I do think trends are evident and that there will be an inevitable challenge to the class struggle notion of Leninist regimes, what is far from inevitable is the defeat of those who stand for the class struggle, at least as long as the leader who espouses it can maintain through modern medical science his capacity to live. One of the remarkable things that we've learned in the context of Leninist regimes is that the objective laws of history mean nothing in contrast to death. As long as a dribbling, senile Stalin and Mao can still whisper loud enough to scare the hell out of everybody around them, the laws of history have to be on hold. Which is a rather remarkable instance of the combination of traditional types of power and modern power, which I think characterized the neo-traditional nature of Leninism. Finally, there's Vietnam. Vietnam, I think, presents the analyst of Leninist regimes, and they're Leninist, not Marxist, with one of the most intriguing phenomena in that world, and that's because the Vietnamese leadership has to simultaneously deal with three developmental stages. It has to deal with the initial stage of transformation and coming to grips with the South. It has to deal with the consolidation phase of preventing the infiltration of the class enemy through attempting collectivization and effective organizational control. And it has to deal also with the fact that the Vietnamese population, at least in the North and in good measure, supported a leadership during the most traumatic experience in probably, or one of the most traumatic experiences in the 20th century. The Polish experience of World War II is probably every bit as great as Vietnam's, but the fact that there are two hardly takes away from the extraordinary nature of what happened in Vietnam, no matter how you evaluate it, in the 20th century. Well, in some respects, Professor Scalapino recognizes that Vietnam is different. He says, and I'm quoting, "Unlike China and North Korea, Vietnam remains an early post-revolutionary stage with concern about enemy classes and counter-revolutionary forces still high. I think that recognition is well deserved, and I would simply add to it the following. It tells you something about the nature of political conflict in Vietnam. In Vietnam, what you are going to find is a basis for three types of elites with three types of policies espousing three types of organizations to deal with three different tasks. There are going to be people who say we have to deal with the South. It really isn't conquered. There are going to be people that say we have to consolidate. And those are the people that will always use the word vigilance, whatever that is in Vietnamese. to say we have to watch out for the penetration of the class enemy. And there are those people who are going to say our people have supported us for 40 years, and it's now time to reconcile them rather than to dominate. It's time to engage them rather than to distrust them. And consequently, the premium placed on political skills in the Vietnamese elite is greater than in any Leninist regime today. Which leads me to the Pike piece, which I find is both extreme in its language and presents the most stereotyped portrait of Vietnam that even an amateur like myself can imagine. To begin with, the language used in this piece is extreme, and as far as I can see, and it is written in English and I read the language, it's unsubstantiated. According to Pike, Vietnam's political institutions are warped. I don't know what that means. It may mean something, but I do not know what it means because it isn't made clear. It is also asserted that the leadership is paranoid. I don't know what the basis for concluding that is. I could find a very good reason for assuming without ever having met a Vietnamese, let alone a member of the Politburo, that there is good reason for the Politburo in Vietnam to be anxious. I would say that in light of a traumatic war experience which devastated the country, the inheritance of the South with a very different culture historically and non-culture in Saigon, a maniacal Pol Pot next door, weak as he may have been, nevertheless maniacal and proximate, and a punishing China, I think that regardless of one's political orientation towards Vietnam, and regardless of one's degree of knowledge about Vietnam, a large element of political anxiety in that leadership would be expected. The argument then proceeds to make the observation that the leadership in Vietnam, particularly this gerontocratic group of five dogmatists, are characterized by low to near absent adaptability. And my question, and not provocatively or polemically, is adaptability compared to who and what? My reading of the secondary literature on Vietnam, which might come as a surprise from someone who also reads about Romania, but nevertheless, my reading of what goes on in Vietnam points to several instances of adaptability. Six members of the Politburo have been removed in recent years. That's a remarkable number to remove from a Politburo of any communist country. Technocrats have entered the State Planning Commission, I believe, and I can stand corrected on all these. Control stations have been removed in the South. The director of the Southern region, who used to be the head of agriculture, is someone who's argued persistently against the use of haste and collectivizing, against the use of violence. Now, this may be rhetoric, but it stands out to me as at least formal recognition of the need to adapt, as does the criticism of haste made at the Sixth Plenum of the Central Committee in Vietnam in the summer of 79. Now, the economy is a mess. That Mr. Pike, but it's a mess compared to what? Is it a mess compared to South Korea? Yes. Is it a mess compared to Zaire? No. Is it a mess compared to Ghana? No. Is it a mess compared to Bolivia? I'm not sure. What is this mess compared to, and in light of what experience over the last 30 years? Furthermore, the notion that Mr. Pike points out that this could have been managed, the post-war situation could have been managed in a way not to drain resources by handling the South, the Cambodian, and the China question in a more judicious way, I think is remarkably insensitive to context. It's like accusing a person who's been in the desert for 5 days without any water when he discovers it for not sitting down, washing his hands, testing the water to see how nicely it tastes, and then finally having a sip. When you're thirsty, you drink. Well, I'm suggesting that the Vietnamese, in the context of a war with the United States, problems with the Chinese for a number of years prior to the end of the war, were not about to engage in rational choice making. That is to say, they were not going to follow Adam Smith's notion and all leave for a conference in Hawaii and decide what is the most judicious way now to deal with the South, the Cambodians, and the Chinese. One has to have empathy, if not sympathy, for the nature of the situation in which these actors were acting. And it was one of trauma. It does not excuse everything they've done. I don't mean excuse politically, even. I mean, it doesn't excuse the fact that they might have not taken more into account, but it certainly does provide them with a sense of why they did what they did and why they weren't as judicious as one might have liked them to have been, and as most of us aren't ourselves. There are several other interesting points, and I'll only spend two or three minutes going over them. One of them has to do with the point that is made about the politics of clandestinism in Vietnam. I found this a very suggestive and an important observation, which unfortunately, again, was destroyed by its exaggerated presentation. The argument is made about the politics of clandestinism in Vietnam that indeed it is related to the situation and historical experience of the Vietnamese, but also it seems to be an ingrained in Vietnamese personality. I am suspicious of anything ingrained in anybody's personality. I remember Richard Solomon telling me and telling the world that the Chinese had this unique horror of face-to-face conflict, and that this was what made the Chinese as a political culture unique in the world. The problem was that Michel Crozier made the exact same claim for the French in a book written in the same year, which led me to believe either that the Chinese had originally settled France or vice versa. The notion of ingrained personalities is not really a very useful way to proceed. Furthermore, this notion that the Vietnamese have a political gene that orients them to clandestinism and results in clandestine behavior being unmatched in any part of the world, I would suggest reading simply a couple of articles about Soviet Georgia. There you will see either a transplanted Vietnamese culture or one that indigenously developed with a level of clandestine behavior and orientation that will take on anybody. There's also the presumed sinic malady of factionalism, which plagues Asian countries. It seems to me that if one looks at the history of the Yugoslav and Romanian parties, certainly in the history of the Comintern, I will match them faction for faction against any Asian anywhere at any time. And then, of course, there are the ethnic jokes that abound from every ethnic group where you find two Jews, you find three opinions, the Greeks say the same thing, and so on and so forth. This sort of thing, I think, destroys the very real insight that is present in the Pike piece about political culture, about its integral role in affecting the operation of the official realm, which is something I think that should be developed, and that is indeed interesting. I'll conclude with three observations that I guarantee will not take longer than 2 minutes. I think that the point made, particularly in Professor Scalapino's piece, that the choice that Leninist regimes face between continuing class struggle with all that involves for strategy and political organization is the most character-defining choice they face in their development. I would add to that that this choice is inevitably confronted in each regime. They can't avoid it. But what is not inevitable is its resolution. Its resolution can be indecisive as in North Korea, decisive as in China, or simply put off as in the case of Vietnam. It is always traumatic, it is always vicious, and consequently, it is varied and interesting. When the choice is made, as it has been made in most Leninist regimes in the last decade, these post-class struggle, or what I have called in an article written almost 10 years ago, when they reach the stage of what I called inclusion, these regimes rest on a very faulted foundation. And that foundation is characterized by the confrontation of a party that claims to be charismatic, to enjoy a superior status, unwilling to play a political role, unwilling to elevate the role of citizenship to that which would encompass the role of party member. Claiming privilege, and like the knights in the 16th century, no longer having any heroic task to justify their privilege. This group of courtiers, and that's what these cadres have become, privileged, corrupt courtiers, faces a society that is not, in the first instance, skilled. I've listened to the economist and the political sociologist too long make this error, that the major change that occurs in communist countries that forces change is that these countries become technologically and economically complex. So was Hitler's Germany. And the SS was having one hell of a good time running it. It is not simply the appearance of skilled technocrats. It's the appearance of articulate social audiences that provide the greatest threat to Leninist regimes. And the best example of that is solidarity in Poland. And the greatest danger that faces Leninist regimes is that the articulate social heterogeneity that they have in part created will translate itself into a political plurality.
Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Jowitt, for the fascinating and witty presentation and comments you have made. We really enjoyed. May I now turn to Anne and to give her comments, and after that we're going to continue with the paper writers. Please, Anne.
Well, I am pleased to that Professor Jowitt has stolen a good bit of what little thunder I may have had. As someone who is not a sufficient specialist, not at all, in this particular area, to comment, to have the empirical background to comment, I would like to suggest or present what fascinated me as I read these papers, which is the, shall we say, developmental or changing modes of analysis over periods of time, the kinds of conceptualizations one uses, given an initial stage, relatively inadequate data, and a later stage, a sufficient opening up to have more data of the past and more access to the present. The operational code approach, as many of you know, was developed originally by Nathan Leiters to look at the Soviet leadership. And that was at a time, perhaps, when information was less accessible than it is now. And I know it's a useful, I think it's a very useful tool, although I think one needs far more data to be able to do it very well. I note that Doug Pike has used it for a situation in which the operations of the leadership, as he himself recognizes, cannot have to be seen through many different filters. And that may perhaps explain why there are some internal inconsistencies which possibly can be reconciled. I'd like to ask him whether they, how they can be. The notion of the clandestine mode struck a familiar chord in me, in the sense that I recall many years ago when I was at Yale hearing Paul Mew explain modes of communication dependent on gestures, signals, and what we would call body language, almost a sort of approximate to a form of Zen communication. And I find it a little difficult to reconcile, in the first place, the emphasis on clandestinity as a perhaps traditional mode of communication which facilitated organizations existing beneath organizations so successfully, and on the other hand, the mode of smashing the opposition. Because it would seem to me that insofar as both mode as well as organizational style in a clandestine fashion would have to open up those who operated to a sensitivity to responses. It would then seem that these two don't seem to go as operational modes with the same kind of leadership. One would seem to be, how would I put it, almost at odds with the other. Insofar as, I'm not sure, by the way, that I agree with, I think Ken Jowitt may have gone a little too far in wanting to, shall we say, do away completely with a culture and personality approach.
As I mentioned,
because, oh, perhaps I misunderstood you. Because I feel that if this isn't too far reduced, if there isn't reductionism, one can certainly argue that there are patterns of group or cultural responses to certain kinds of situations. And as I mentioned the other day, having noticed certain kinds of both situational and context similarities where I live now and where I lived in Southeast Asia, I begin to wonder whether how much specific country or sub-country cultural definitions perhaps represent the kinds of expressions and dealing with situations that may be characteristic of similar contextual situations and the people who live in them in widely varying countries. Nonetheless, may I illustrate a minute from this from Doug's paper. One of the characteristics he notes is what he calls, in the younger generation at least, a naive idealism with a notion of perfectibility of society or progress, or the notion that all social problems have solutions. Well, we could just as well say that that has been a sort of a characteristic mode of orientation of Americans over a long period. Let me ask to what extent one, how would I put it, if you would try to see how the smashing the opposition can be reconciled, if it can be reconciled, with the, what you call, I think when other terms could be used, the clandestine approach to both organization and communication. I was struck when looking at the titles of papers to see there had been a misprint, which I only realized afterwards, but I was struck with the title of the paper on North Korea, which had the term monarchy. Obviously that was a misprint. But both that, monocracy, if one thinks of monocracy and one thinks of monarchy,
of Leninist regime, and what happens in
combining that to some extent with
in another
my responses to Bob Scalapino's paper,
let me raise the
raises the question of to what extent there is or has been, or could be said to be, a kind of natural history of Leninist regimes, and what happens in one can to some extent be replicated in another over time.
On the one hand,
or and let me raise the question alternatively, are our ways of looking at these societies changed as they as these systems mature over time? So that on the one hand we have the developmental construct and the stage construct, and then look for
in terms of developmental stages,
a sort of from wistfully the, look for convergence
or
theories
in the neo-traditional sense. Or monocratic.
And whether we perhaps see more convergence that is likely to occur,
hero, king,
or see more in terms of developmental stages from the, whether one calls it monarchical or in the neo-traditional sense, or monocratic, to use a more modern term, the hero, king, the charismatic leader as an almost necessary first stage, the traditional father, however one wants to put that. And then at a later stage, we are looking, as so many people apparently found, in disguised interest groups in the Soviet Union, tried to apply interest group theory in looking for convergence. But I think the point I really, in one sense, want to make more or suggest here is as we look at leadership decision making, we use many ex post facto evaluative terms, as this was a poor decision, this was a good decision,
of leadership
and
confronted with
perhaps
very often.
One might emphasize, and I liked very much Kent's certainly point on the contingency of certain decisions. Perhaps in evaluating certain decisions, we might try to put ourselves into the position
even
of leadership
of elite
confronted with very often inadequate information.
Certainly
inadequate feedback, especially in systems in which correct feedback in any fashion is difficult to obtain, even through a hierarchy of elites and sub-elites.
And available information,
ask whether certain decisions were made, as they have been made in all societies, not so much in terms of ideological blinkers,
given both
or whether they were perhaps the best possible decisions based upon both available information and
may not necessarily
perceptions of strategies that were the best possible given both short-range situations and goals and long-range goals.
In China,
therefore,
increases
I think
in
I would
very many
suggest
forms of
perhaps
and productivity
that we may not necessarily see, despite economic development, despite the over time, both in the Soviet Union and in China, increases in very many forms of production and productivity, increases in standards of living, a kind of, shall we say, proto-middle class society, a kind of development of, shall we say, subterranean interest groups or whatever name we want to call them. Could we perhaps be looking at long-range pendulum swings? Long-range pendulum swings in which there will be, shall we say, releases from tight constriction of control to allow for experiments in which will involve, shall we say, corrections in terms of unanticipated consequences or in terms of what we would call slow feedback. And therefore, one is not likely over a long range to see
what
one
might
call Western liberal wish for convergence, either convergence between Western systems and more mature Leninist systems, between less mature Leninist systems and more mature Leninist systems, that what we might see, I'm throwing this out as a question to those who are more familiar with these systems than I am, whether what we might not see is in each society, such society, various versions of dealing with what in shorthand one might call the necessity to recognize expertise or the need for technocrats and the necessity to retain loyalty and some simulacrum of an orientation toward an ultimate classless society.
That
there would be what I think economists, some economists, please correct me. I understand that there is a theory, the Kondratiev theory, something like that, of long-range swings and short-range swings in economic cycles. And that perhaps one might look at, if one tries to discern patterns over time, given different stages or different periods in each of these systems, whether we might not see something like similarities in short-run swings and similarities in long-run swings with certain cyclical moves from tighter or looser controls from the center.
On some of them, I want to have a chance to.
Thank you, Anne. And now I turn to the paper writers. I hope that we can stay within about 10 minutes each.
Central
Please, Bob.
Issue that runs through the comments and my paper.
Thank you very much.
The other papers as well.
Well, I enjoyed these comments, and on some of them, I want to have a chance to think further. Let me plunge into what I think is the kind of central issue that runs through the comments and my paper and perhaps the other papers as well. I agree with Ken Zhao's opening remark that there is an inevitable and I suspect eternal tension between the concept of charisma and that of legalization or legalism,
I think that
between that of an anointed party or leadership or elite and that of the concept of a total people
on the other hand,
or an integrated state. In which there is an effort to encompass all. I think that tension, that contradiction exists in Marxist-Leninist systems and can never be fully reconciled. On the other hand, let me challenge Ken's opening remarks, which I think he himself challenged at the end of his remarks, when he said that there is no possibility, as I understood him, and this defined my relative radicalism versus his conservatism. I'm going to cherish that. Let me become maybe more